Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with the one and only...
Tom Hiddleston.
And director...
Mark Abraham.
And we're here to talk about the new Hank Williams biopic, I Saw the Light. Gentlemen, thanks so much for taking the time. We really appreciate it. Let's just start. When did you first discover this awesome Hank Williams music? I mean, for me, it was through my grandfather. He used to play in a country band until he cut off his thumb and all that stuff. So I grew up listening to that sort of stuff, you know. But what was it for you guys?
You know, I can't remember that. All I know is that I've known the words to Hey Good Looking for a long time. I don't know why or how, but people say to me that Hey Good Looking's like Happy Birthday. It's one of those things you can start singing Hey Good Looking anywhere in the world and people will join in.
Respond what you're cooking.
And they often don't know that it's Hank Williams. So that's how I knew Hank. But until I read the script, I really had nothing. I had no knowledge of his life, his circumstances, his marriage. All that stuff was new to me.
Right. How about you, sir? When did you discover Hank's music?
Well, my grandfather didn't play in a country band, and he didn't cut off his thumb, although he could have because he was a butcher.
Heard it here first.
However, I grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, which is up I-65 from Nashville. So I was a country music fan pretty much my whole life. I started listening to it when I was very young, and I listened to George Jones and then Merle, and then a big Kris Kristofferson fan, and Willie. And ultimately, though, as I've always said, if you are listening to those guys and you're listening to the radio, no DJ is going to play a set without eventually playing a Hank Williams song. And so I started hearing all Hank. And I knew a lot of Hank songs before I even decided to write the piece of material about him, write the script. I ultimately knew a lot about Hank because after I got older, I started doing some research on Hank. I just thought his life was just so extraordinary, and he had died so young, and so few people knew that he had died that. I mean, because you look at pictures.
In his 20s, right?
He was 29 years old. Yeah. So when you see him, he looks like he's 45, and then you find out he was only 2 months into his 29th birthday.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Now, how did you go about sculpting the voice for that? What sort of research does that involve? Obviously, listening to the songs over and over again, but how did you go about sort of mastering that? Because some of those inflections are tough, you know, especially like a Lovesick Blues. There's a lot of up and downs, and, you know, that wail is very, you know, signature. So how did you sculpt it? And then kind of piggybacking with that question, was there a certain song that came more natural, and was there one that took a little more work to get those inflections?
Jason, I can tell you, I've recorded Why Don't You Love Me in an hour, which is featured in the movie, and I recorded Lovesick Blues in about 10 days.
There you go.
Lovesick Blues was my Mount Everest, because Hank's control over that song is so masterful. And you know, he used to say when he performed it live, he said the song I've played the 13 million and one half times. He had the luxury and the privilege of having practiced it for years, and I had about 2 weeks. And the thing I did, and I couldn't have done it without him, was I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and I lived as a guest of Rodney Crowell, who was our executive music producer and my guide through the woods. He himself is a huge Hank Williams fan. He saw Hank Sr. on his own father's shoulders at the age of 2 when he was a child. It's one of his earliest memories. And he's been playing music for 40 years, understands Hank's music, the footprint of Hank's music on the rest of 20th century culture. And he was able to to piece it out for me and to deconstruct it and demystify it. And like you do anything, if I was playing an Olympic sprinter, I'd have to run a certain number of miles a day.
Different biopic. That's Jesse Owens.
Right. But there was an element of, look, it just, you know, it just takes practice. You just have to keep going back into the studio and having another go. And every day it would get better and better. I would have more control over the songs and more fun with it. In the end, it was a mixture of control and release, like all things, actually, all physical things. There's part of you that has to be very precise, another part of you has to be very free. Yeah. Anyway, eventually, I think we cracked it.
Right. Definitely. I think the your cheating heart scene in particular, I think that works really, really well. So nice work.
That was one of the ones that we insisted, Rodney and Mark both insisted I sing live, because your cheating, the lyrics to your cheating heart are so pained and so sad that I, in order to transmit that, I didn't want to record it ahead of time. And I wanted to actually, it was actually an acting challenge as much as it was a singing challenge. Sure. Because what I needed to convey was the pain he was in and how that was connected to the song, which is an acting job as opposed to a singing job. It's an interesting thing.
And when Hank recorded Your Cheating Heart, it was one of five songs he recorded in his last recording session. Two of them ended up going, I think, becoming number one or number twos. And Your Cheating Heart, there was no, never played while he was alive.
Wow.
You know, yeah. Because he recorded, maybe just at the very, very end, because he recorded it and he was in such pain, he did it sitting down. He was exhausted at the end of that, and Tom just beautifully renders that pain.
Awesome. Now, so cracking the vocal structure and everything was sort of his job, but for you, you know, I thought it picked up on some little directorial symbolism you're going. He's often lying down in the back of cars. Is that something that was in the script, or did you write that not in the script and then you came at that from as a director, or was that even conscious?
Well, I mean, the thing is that Hank was in pain. His back was always painful for him. They didn't discover he had spina bifida occulta until he was much older. So pretty much whenever he had a chance to lie down, he did. He took the weight off. And in those days, traveling around, they didn't have tour buses like Willie's got these days. They were traveling around in the back of that Packard, and it was painful, it was exhausting, and Hank, you know, commandeered, he was the big boss, so he commandeered as much space as he possibly could. And that, it was a conscious effort.
So was there a little foreshadowing in it, or more just his back hurt?
I think, well, that's an interesting question. I think mostly it was about his back really hurting, was the truth of it. We do have to make these interpretations of it.
You know, and look for that stuff.
Yeah. You know, what we strove for always, Jason, was authenticity. We were really trying to make sure that the film and not, you know, iconic. Much more human. The film is a very human portrait of him. It's not the big moments in his life. It's actually mostly the small moments in his life that we really were striving for. So when you pick up on that, it's really about just a guy who was making his way around the country trying to sell his music.
Definitely. Take me into, so that's sort of a director question. Let's go into a writer sort of thing. The framing device with, Bradley Whitford, kind of recalling and sort of like, direct address, sort of docu-style. Tell me into how you made that decision. And if you'll indulge me, you could have gone another direction too. Are you aware of David Allan Coe's The Ride? With that song, The Ride, where the stranger picks up, he's a thumbing from Montgomery with the guitar on his back and picks up the ghost of Hank Williams. Could have gone that route, but how do you decide on which route?
Well,
it's a little more supernatural.
Yeah, that's a little supernatural and takes place at midnight, I think. And I think so we'd have had a very dark movie.
It's really light as it is.
But I think that what I loved about the Bradley Whitford character was I tried not to make it so much that you knew he was speaking in the past or in the future. He was just talking about Hank. And what Bradley's a wonderful actor, and there's a certain amount of just a spontaneous way that we did that. My goal in that was simply that there's a lot of information that takes place in movies, and particularly movies that are about real people. And you can do it a lot of different ways. You can have the dialogue have a lot of exposition in it, which is my least favorite thing in the world. You'll notice, and obviously you're paying attention to a lot of the smaller details, even the conversations are very elliptical. Like they have conversations where they're in a hotel, in a hospital room, and Hank's talking to his wife, Audrey, and she asks him a question, and he answers her with a question. It's very real dialogue.
That's how people talk,
It's how people talk. And what I really wanted to avoid was the idea of having to have Hank or Audrey or somebody within the context of the film, particularly, giving us information about what was taking place. So I kind of cribbed it from something else. Some of Bob Fosse's used a similar technique, a great filmmaker, one I admire tremendously. And I thought that there was a way I could sort of adapt it to this and have...
What Fosse is in here? Are we talking like All That Jazz or Cabaret?
We're talking about in Lenny.
Okay.
He actually used a similar thing. It's not exactly what we did. But I thought that it was a great way to use Bradley as Fred Rose, speaking in a very, authoritative way about things he knew a lot about, and take that off the table so that our characters were free to actually have real relationships and not necessarily be Eddie the explainer.
Did producing a biopic like The Hurricane help you, you know, have experience sort of in this realm so you knew what to do when you sat down to do it yourself?
I didn't think about it. I think I thought more about the films that other filmmakers, I think Norman Jewison is a very fine filmmaker, but I think I was... No, I don't think so. I really just, but interestingly enough, films like All That Jazz and Lenny and Raging Bull, which are movies that don't really explain why Jake LaMotta, who he is, don't pick him up as a young boy, getting beat up by a bunch of kids on the street, so you see he becomes a fighter.
And ends in the nightclub.
Yeah. I love those kind of movies. And those films were much more influential for me.
Gotcha. And Tom, so you, I believe, if I remember correctly, you in Midnight in Paris, you were F. Scott, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just buried in my brain. But the reason I bring that up is because, you know, you've had some experience playing sort of the alcoholic womanizing type before. Is there compare F. Scott and Zelda's relationship as you understood it to Hank and Elizabeth Olsen here?
Oh, that's actually you're the first person to ever make that comparison or ask that.
Good job, man.
It's good. It's smart. Well, the first thing I think is to point out the differences in their education. I think, to some extent, well, differences and similarities. I think Scott and Zelda were just, they were a lot more sophisticated. They were a lot more educated. They had that sort of Princeton sheen and smoothness of that particular time. They had immense style. And their indulgences were more of the champagne variety as opposed to the whiskey variety.
Yeah.
But I do think, and here's the thing that I've never said in talking about this film, you're the first person who's asked, is that there would be no F. Scott Fitzgerald without Zelda, and there would be no Hank Williams without Audrey. And I think their relationships and their marriage, the intensity of the passion contained in those relationships is what gave each of those men an engine to create their best work.
Yeah. I couldn't help when you were sitting out on the porch in some of those scenes and shooting holes through the couch and stuff. You could have easily just transposed F. Scott and Zelda. So
maybe.
Nice work, sir.
But just thrown in the odd old sport and had a different hair color, maybe would have worked.
The old sport, yeah. The old Gatsby trick. Awesome. I'm going to make you make him blush a little bit, if you don't mind. But compare, we were talking about Midnight in Paris. Compare, let's say, the styles of like a Woody Allen versus a Guillermo del Toro in Crimson Peak, which was a very stylish movie, and he's a wild filmmaker himself, versus this gentleman right here.
Well, you know, I couldn't have done this without him. I couldn't have done any of this without Mark. And his enormous compassion and generosity of spirit, which was first laid bare in the screenplay, as he wanted to take Hank off the pedestal and examine his relationships. And his patience and his wisdom and the fact that he was always at my side, you know, the two of us in a foxhole together for so many years, and whenever I had a question, he was always open and available to have a conversation about it. And I think the sensitivity of the relationships as displayed in this film come entirely from Mark, because he gave us the space to explore it, and he has the sophistication, the experience about people to know that people are complex and contradictory and they get in their own way. And they mean well, but sometimes they trip up. And Mark's an incredibly wise man. And that I couldn't have
there
done.
There it is, there's the blush. No, I'm just kidding.
And it was great. And we had so many conversations. It was what I always see as an actor, I feel like an instrument in the orchestra. And so I know, let's say I'm playing lead trombone or lead fiddle or something, but I'm an instrument in the orchestra. And every time I go to work, it's my job to play to the tune of a new conductor or a new composer. The director has the baton, whether it's Woody Allen or Guillermo del Toro or Mark Abraham or whoever else, yeah. Kenneth Branagh or Steven Spielberg or the other people I've worked with. And
I like the company.
But you have to play according to the, you're led by the conductor. And that's part of the fascination of being an actor, is that you find yourself sharpening the instrument, as it were, to play the tune, to play to the tune of someone's artistic heartbeat. And that, and so, you know, syncing up with Mark on this was a huge pleasure.
Awesome. Now, you guys saw I got the one question thing left, so I want to ask.
Wait, I should say, Woody Allen doesn't give you as many takes as Mark Abraham.
And I don't give that man. Yeah.
Mark is more open to persuasion. If I think my performance is perfectible, I can always ask Mark for another go, whereas Woody wants to get out of there by 4. Yeah.
he's been, it's not his first rodeo, maybe that's why he's been around a while. Awesome. Well, I think we're down to the last question, but I wanted to ask, Batman, Superman's dominating right now, and you're probably one of the most famous villains of this whole era as Loki. I think I read Superman's maybe your favorite superhero, right? Is that right?
Well, I've said that before, because I'll never forget the first time I must have seen Superman, directed by Richard Donner, mm-hmm. with Christopher Reeve, when I was 5 or 6 years old.
1978.
Yeah, and I probably saw it on VHS or on television. And I was like, I don't think I've ever seen anything greater than that in all my days. There are only 5 years worth of days. Yeah. But as a kid, Christopher Reeve was, I'll never forget it, he was the first real superhero.
What would Loki, what would his strategy be against Batman and Superman? How would he take both of them out?
I think he'd be amused that the children are playing. He'd sit high up in a tree and watch them throw rocks at each other. I honestly don't know. I mean, you're giving birth to a whole idea here, which is the idea that the Marvel universe could somehow cross-pollinate with the DC universe. I mean, fans' minds will explode at this point. Like, I don't know. What would Loki be like? I don't know. It'd be interesting. I feel like Superman would present a challenge, but he's got form with people who wear red capes and fly around. Thor has a red cape and flies around a lot. So I think he would be... he'd just be slightly exasperated by their need to go another 15 rounds in the ring. Do we have to do this? You know what I mean? I've been here before. I couldn't possibly tell you. I think he'd just be generally amused and patronizing about the whole thing.
I think all you'd have to do is take a country guitar and smash it over both of them. Hey, thanks so much, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
That's right.